Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio, and glad to have you with us on this Friday. Our guest this hour is Tad Johnson, and he's a member of the Boys Fort Band of Chippewa in northern Minnesota. He went to law school at the University of Minnesota and worked for Congress as a deputy counsel on Indian affairs. He also briefly served as the chairman of the National Indian Gaming Commission during the Clinton administration, and he's worked in private practice and served as a tribal attorney. Now he heads the Masters of Tribal Administration and Governance program at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. And this week, Johnson was on the Boyce Fort Reservation to conduct a training with Minnesota State employees on tribal consultation. The training comes a week after the Minnesota Department of Transportation apologized to the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa for desecrating burial sites as a part of the state's Highway 23 project. Johnson took some time to speak with me this week about the history of tribal consultation with the state and federal government.
For the most part, there wasn't a great deal of tribal consultation throughout American history. It's a fairly recent phenomenon. Tribes started getting their voice in Congress during the 1970s or 60s and 70s when there were movements going on. So there had been the National Congress of American Indians around since 1944, but Congress still did what they did called the termination period for Indian tribes in the 1950s. And so that began to be reversed in the early 70s when tribes started, providing testimony in front of congressional hearings. And then probably the passing of the Indian Self-Determination Act in 1975 made a big difference because suddenly Indian people were taking over what formerly were Bureau of Indian Affairs and Indian Health Service programs. So there had to be more discussion between the tribes and the United States. And then after a while, that became a regular thing where the Bureau of Indian Affairs, some people used to refer to the BIA as Boss Indians Around. And in the age of self-determination, as the tribes found their voice more and more, they were testifying at hearings. They were getting jobs in Washington. They were putting together, tribes were putting together their own lobbying entities, whether it was the National Congress of American Indian, or there's also a lobbying entity for housing, one for healthcare, and certainly the National Indian Gaming Association became more powerful during the 90s. But it got to the point where the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service found that they couldn't really make a move, in the late 70s, early 80s, without consulting with the tribes. And so that became their modus operandi after that. And then there was, additional policy changes, but a number of positive things happened in the 80s, 70s and 80s with regard to legislation. Whether it was, the 1972 Indian Education Act that encouraged American Indian parents to get more involved in the education of their children, the Self-Determination Act, the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978 certainly required states and tribes to be have a little more of a discourse. But, a lot of the Indian policies start with the federal government because the federal government is the main entity that deals with Indian tribes. And then states coordinating or consulting matters with Indian tribes came later. It was kind of a way of life for the federal government because they have a trust responsibility to the Indian tribes and Indian people. And they have a duty to and an obligation, a legal obligation to make sure they're making Indian land productive, to make sure that they're taking care of tribal assets and whether it's resources or other matters. So they have a legal obligation to be to be checking with the tribes on how they're doing. So the first time President Obama met with the tribes in 2009, he met with all the tribes, and he did it every year for the rest of his presidency. But he wanted to know, what was the best way to talk to them, to do consultation. And he required all federal agencies to do some type of consultation policies with Indian tribes. And so, no matter how remote the federal agency was from Indian tribes, they were all required to do consultation policies. So with states, it came much later, and it came more as a, in talking with tribes, frequently as the 20th century came about, in the mid 20th century, and then the latter part of the 20th century, the federal government became a little more understanding of how they were supposed to deal with Indian tribes. Although, lately I think the DAPL situation out in North Dakota indicates that they don't always do it terribly well, but they are required to go out and talk with Indian tribes anyway. The states kind of recognized kind of late that they are going to be dealing with Indian tribes, whether they're building roads or conducting natural resources policy or doing other things, because tribes have treaty rights. The laws of states essentially don't apply within tribal reservation boundaries, and so they had to figure out a workaround, a way to deal with Indian tribes. So the first governor in Minnesota to do a tribal consultation policy, ironically, was Jesse Ventura. And then Governor Pawlenty ended up pretty much adopting something similar to what Governor Ventura had done. And then when Governor Dayton came in, he decided to revise the policy and update it. And so, he got some input from some of us out in Indian country. And anyway, he improved the policy and also included in his new policy that there would be training required for state employees that were going to be working with Indian tribes and or with Indian people. And so he signed that order in 2013, and it requires that most agencies in the state create a tribal consultation policy. And then the training started, and that was we did a pilot project at the University of Minnesota Duluth, working rather closely with MnDOT. And actually, ironically, it's the Minnesota Department of Transportation that's in a bit of hot water right now, but they are actually trying quite vigorously to conduct tribal consultation and also got actively involved in the training process. So this process we're doing today is underwritten by the Minnesota Department of Transportation. So when I heard the news reports on what had happened out on Highway 23, which I don't really want to comment on that much, but I knew Commissioner Zelli, and he's spoken at a number of these conferences, and I think he's a very good public servant, and apologized. And anyway, it was a huge mistake, obviously, on their part. And some of us think the main remedy will be training and doing more discussions with tribes, just sort of asking, do we dig here? Do we, what's here, or how? And working together with tribes. Otherwise, mistakes like were made recently will happen again, and they probably will happen again. But I think the important thing is that how the agency reacts and where we go from here and how to prevent these things in the future. And so we conduct this training. So we do about 100 state employees at a time. We've done, I believe, 1,700 state employees so far with this training. So, and the University of Minnesota Duluth Continuing Education Department, along with the American Indian Studies Department, does the training. And then day one is another professor and I go through about 500 years of policy, and from the first incursion of the Europeans to the recent age of tribal self-determination and Indian gaming. And you know, we talk about there's a federal repatriation act about sort of the historical lack of respect that the United States had for skeletal remains of American Indian people, and they had a great many skeletons out in literally human remains out in first in the Smithsonian and then other museums on the East Coast. And in the 1990 Native American Graves Repatriation Act, it was required that those museums that received federal funding were mandated to return those human remains back to the tribes they were supposed to go to. And so part of American history was a lack of respect for human remains. And so that's why it was particularly devastating what happened. But as I said, the important thing is where we go from here. And to me, the answers are our training and talking to the tribes.
Well, I'm just surprised that, the actual state consultation policy is relatively new compared to, what's been happening at the federal level.
Yeah. Well, it's most of the conflicts that Indian tribes will have, whether it's hunting and fishing and gathering rights or the right to do gaming, or most conflicts these days are between states and tribes, and probably even more so between counties and tribes. And so it seems like the governments that are closer to the reservations, whether it's municipalities or counties, tend to be the entities that tribes have the most friction with. And it's really, from my perspective, the state is, obviously still making mistakes, but they're at least trying to understand what they're supposed to be doing. The last line of education, and which probably should have been first, are the municipalities and the counties that surround the Indian reservations, because that's where a great deal of friction tends to erupt, and everything from misunderstandings to lawsuits. And so what the training is really about, and the way we believe we can more than justify the funding for it, is if we can avoid one costly lawsuit help create understanding where there was misunderstanding, then we've done something good and possibly saved the state some money and the tribes, because if there's a lawsuit, both sides end up paying. So, and we've seen, long costly lawsuits here in Minnesota. And I know that you have in Wisconsin too, on hunting, fishing, and gathering matters. And I mean, that costs in not only dollars, but also just in some types of personal animosity, some racial issues, and then it ultimately affects kids on playgrounds and anyway, that's not good for anybody. So so the fewer conflicts we have, we think the better the community becomes.
Well, and I know you said that you've trained about 1,700 employees by what you're doing, but I mean, is it just specifically for Minnesota state employees, or do you also do trainings for Wisconsin? Because I mean, there are tribes in northern Wisconsin, and, you know, Duluth Superior are on the borders of two states. So,
well, first of all, you know, we're funded largely by MnDOT, so yeah, we are kind of limited to state employees. But we've had a number of state agencies come through. But interestingly enough, we have someone here today who's going to be at the training who's from the governor's office in North Dakota. And North Dakota wants to take a look at this training and see if, you know, how it might work out over there, or see if it's something that, works over there. But, you know, it's MnDOT is apparently there's a state employee waiting list to get into this training, which I find very flattering. But so we've been taking, you know, anybody from any state agency. And MnDOT is kind of the gatekeeper for the training. But we have, you know, folks from the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Public Safety. And the State Department of Commerce was not required under the governor's order necessarily to come to the training, but the State Public Utilities Commission, which deals with pipelines, we have a pipeline issue here in Minnesota too, oil pipelines, and so you know, the Commissioner of Commerce is sending people to the training as well. So and it's a matter of you know, the group we have at the Minnesota Department of Transportation keeping the gate on the training, and for me to bring somebody else in is difficult, because sometimes there are you know, some professors that want to sit in on it, and I'll go, well, I'm not running the show, it's the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And we'll have some folks here today from a couple of from North Dakota, from you know, a couple of foundations have an interest in this training, and so so far we haven't had anybody from Wisconsin express interest in it, but we hope they do. So right across from Duluth. So.
Right. Yeah. And you said that in the day one of the training, you go over 500 years of history. And
yeah, well, we can't obviously cover it in the depth we'd like to. But,
right. But, anyway. How much of the understanding the tribal consultation process is understanding tribes and Native American history in itself? I mean, because it seems like part of the issue with that may arise with a lack of consultation directly ties into communication and the different styles based on different cultures.
Yes. We think it's essential, and you know, for those folks who like history, they find the first day fascinating. For those who don't like history, you know, we think it's information they have to have. So we take them through, you know, how the Spanish theologians came up with theories on how to deal with Indian tribes, and that got handed down to the English, and as the Supreme Court was developing precedent and the Constitution was being written, a lot of the ideas of treaty making and other matters came from Europeans, and then the English had made treaties with the Indians, and so. But you know, we get to the Supreme Court cases and the early days of the Republic in the 1820s and 30s. Justice Marshall ended up doing, you know, several important decisions. One of them is Worcester versus Georgia, where he essentially said that the laws of states shall have no force on Indian reservations. And that's usually where I pause and go, you know, therefore the laws of Minnesota have no force on Indian reservations unless the Congress allows it. So Minnesota and Wisconsin are both public law 280 states where criminal statutes apply on some reservations, not all, in Minnesota. Red Lake and Boys Fort, where I'm at today, are not under public law 280, but it allows for 280 allows for the the state criminal laws to apply on the reservations and the county attorneys to do the prosecutions. But unless the Congress says that that states have jurisdiction, they don't. So anyway, so just driving that point home with states is, and I'm kind of like, if you forget everything else I say here today, keep that in mind. And then we do go through the rest of 19th century policy and talk about the importance of acts of Congress as they pass, and then kind of show how the United States evolved to the point where they are pretty much required now to listen to Indian tribes. And, you know, the states are behind on that. And then day two of the training is panels of folks who work on reservations. And sometimes it's tribal state liaisons who are mostly American Indians who work for the state of Minnesota. They kind of like, you know, they explain what they do and then explain. And people have dozens and dozens and dozens of questions about all kinds of things, whether it's state jurisdiction or, you know, why Red Lake's a little different from the rest of the tribes. And, they'll throw out a lot of hypotheticals and anyway, but it's a really good exchange on the second day. And what we do after the first day is have folks write down questions and, essentially, yeah, it starts off with communication, but that's the point we're driving home, is that unless you go out and have a cup of coffee with the tribe, usually there's some, whatever department you're with, there's usually a tribal counterpart, or you can, you know, the higher ups in an organization can meet with a tribal leader. That's kind of just going out having lunch with a tribal leader on the reservation for a state commissioner or an assistant commissioner can make all the difference. If you know, it can avoid conflicts, and then having, you know, the person that works on the ground having a relationship, whether it's from the, usually there's natural resource departments on reservations, and there's always state natural resources departments, and frequently we're butting heads on those matters. And these days they all kind of know each other. But then there are other counterparts too who need to be chatting. So state departments of commerce could probably, it would do them some good to do some talking with the economic development folks on reservations. And I know this stuff happens somewhat informally or sometimes accidentally, but sometimes it's a matter of either the state or the tribe knocking on doors, but just sitting down and saying, here's the issue. And this has gone on informally for years, but now what's happening is more and more governors are doing these required consultation sessions and required consultation policies. Like I sent you one that Governor Dayton did, we went through probably, you know, 10 or 15 other states that had policies that were as good or better than that. And some are not just executive orders. Some are actually written into the state law that there shall be consultation between the native nations of the state and the state, you know, if there is any kind of project or activity that impacts the reservation or the ceded territories of the reservations or of the tribes. So anyway, we have a lot of questions about land in this training.
We're going to take a short break for these announcements. You're listening to an interview with Tad Johnson, who heads the Masters of Tribal Administration and Governance Program at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. This week he was conducting a training with Minnesota State employees on tribal consultation. And when we come back, we'll hear about the role that communication and land plays in tribal consultation. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. In this hour, we've been talking with Tad Johnson, who is a member of the Boy Sport Band of Chippewa in northern Minnesota, and he heads the Masters of Tribal Administration and Governance program at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. And we've been talking about tribal consultation. Johnson conducts trainings with Minnesota State employees about the process of consultation. And up next, he talks about the role that communication and land play in that process. Does it, you know, the way that our society uses technology and relies on email and or texting and all those types of communication, I mean, it seems like that is pretty much how government operates at the federal, state, or local level. And does that make it more difficult then to do tribal consultation? Because it seems like there's more of an importance placed on that face-to-face interaction among tribes as opposed to using email or, you know, maybe just the issues where you send out an email, you think they have received it, and perhaps they didn't.
Yeah, that doesn't work for Indian folks. And I, for example, with the master's program that we developed, having worked with Indian tribes at the state and federal level, and being on both sides of the fence, I was a Fed, and I was also a guy who went and yelled at the whether it was IHS, Indian Health Service, or the BIA for not consulting with us enough. And then I became the on the other side, the guy getting yelled at as a Fed for the National Indian Gaming Commission or with the Congress. But I know you're better off, and I can't generalize about Indian folks because they are the younger generation is a little more adept at texting and emailing and all that sort of thing. But still, it's important. When we were developing our master's program, we spent 2 years going out to all the reservations in the region, and then we also went all the way from Rapid City all the way over to Michigan to do, you know, consult with tribes. And we went to the National Congress of American Indians and said, you know, if we develop this program, what should it look like? And the very first memo I did to UMD when I was a tribal attorney was, first of all, you are the state and the tribes will consider you the enemy. And they were like, what? And I said, well, just trust me on this. Anything you do is going to be suspect on the part of the tribes. So we have to go out and face-to-face talk to them and gain their trust and also tell, you know, keep our word. And so when we developed the program, we did it after talking with tribes for 2 years, and then we rolled it out. We had a meeting on a reservation, and they you know, half the people in the was probably about the first cohort at UMD, they told me, well, you'll get 3 or 4 people with a new graduate program. We had 30 applicants, and several of them were folks we had consulted with. And I would ask them, why'd you decide to apply? And they said, well, you did what we asked. And I, you know, the last thing I wanted to do, I was in my 50s when I started the program, was teach online. But the farther away we got from Duluth, the more tribes wanted it to be online. So we offered an online component, and we wouldn't have known that. It wouldn't have occurred to me at my age that, you know, I'm going to have to learn how to teach online, and we're going to have to be doing that because this is what they want. And, you know, we would keep doing surveys, and what kept popping up to the top was we want to learn more about human resources and personnel issues. Everybody, whether they were the tribal administration or the, you know, the secretary level or the tribal leader, they would say every personnel problem lands on my desk. And then they wanted more about leadership and ethics, so we do a course on that. And they wanted to learn federal Indian law and policy and how the money trickles down from the federal government to them and how to work with states. So all that came out in consultation, so we teach all that in a 2-year program. But you know, on another level, sometimes the lack of communication with Indian tribes. I was involved last year, and this was in the news a bit. A spiritual leader called me up on a Sunday morning and said, another spiritual leader had died in an automobile accident, and he had a heart condition, and he said the state wants to autopsy him. And the medical examiner did not talk to the family, did not talk to, and they just were deciding to take the body and do an autopsy. And he was Madewin. They don't believe in autopsies, as do, you know, there are many faiths that do not believe in autopsies on the body, whether it's Orthodox Jewish folks or Islamic people or Hmong people, and we have a large population of Hmong in Minnesota. And we got a court order and got the body returned to the family. And then the exact same thing happened a few days later to somebody at Fond du Lac. And I had worked with that attorney on trying to get the first body returned, and then we ended up getting a court order. But again, the medical examiner had not talked to the family. Now, if you look on the websites of most medical examiners, it says, yeah, we talk to families all the time. That's our main, you know, we want to make sure we're doing what the family wants, et cetera. But they didn't do it because I think that it was Indian people, and it was northern Minnesota, and that was just, you know, the way they'd been doing things. So we ended up changing the state law on, you know, it impact. We had several other religions with us, but all of that stemmed from the inability of the medical examiner to not talk to the Indian families, and they didn't understand. And when they were told that the Madewin was this religion, they didn't really believe it. And so, I mean, It was a crazy situation, and when we got down to the Twin Cities, they were, you know, the medical examiners down there were like, well, we've never not talked to a family, we've never, you know, we've never called the police. And in those instances in northern Minnesota, the police were called in both, and there were police escorts over to where the autopsy was to be done, and the families were not talked to. So, I mean, that was a, you know, incredible lack of communication. And so I ended up, you know, working with three other attorneys. We wrote a law review article on the situation and just talk about how the failure to communicate in that particular instance. We put into the state law that medical examiners were required to talk to the families, and then if people had a religious freedom objection to autopsies, they could get into court. It doesn't mean they'll win. In fact, they'll probably lose most of the time, because usually there's a justifiable state interest to do an autopsy. But the folks, everybody in that instance, wanted their day in court, from the family to the medical examiner. But the law before was that the medical examiner had no legal obligation under the statute to talk to the families. Even though most of them did, you know, we had all this testimony in front of the state legislature that, oh, yeah, we always talk to the families. And, you know, then we had testimony from these families saying, no, that's not what happened in northern Minnesota. So anyway, communication is everything on, you know, for these, you know, these instances where there's this impasse or this total misunderstanding of culture or information that tribes have that they may not necessarily want to give out to the state, but they could simply say, do not dig here. And anyway, so instances where you know, situations can be averted with a little bit of Minnesota nice and a little bit of conversation. And anyway, so but it was, what's ironic about that whole piece of legislation was, and this is what we summarized at the end of the law review article, if they had just talked a little with the family, if they had been a little nicer, we wouldn't have required, the law would not needed to have been changed. But, you know, we closed with a quote from Madison, who said that, you know, if if all men were angels, there would be no need for government. So, but
right.
Anyway, so.
Well, before you were mentioning land and how that tends to come up as far as many of the conversations resulting around tribal consultation. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you about that because it seems like there can be a tricky sort of gray area related to land because of how land can sometimes be under state ownership, but it was formerly under tribal ownership. And so how does that all work, you know, where maybe it's not formally owned by the tribe, but maybe it's ceded territory and states think that they're being above board or local governments think they're doing everything right, but really there's something they haven't considered because of historic treaties or something like that.
Yes. So, yeah, there's a number of different types of land, and that's another reason why we go through the history. In 1887, the United States government decided to try to make the Indians farmers. So, and it was partly because, I mean, there was a faction in Congress that wanted to help assimilate the Indians. So they would send them to boarding schools. And also, under this General Allotment Act, they decided we'll divide up the reservations into and provide the Indians with land ownership so that, you know, a family will get a 40-acre parcel, or depending on the size of the family, it would be a multiple of 40 acres. And so they would do that. They'd divide up the reservation quite a bit into individual allotments. And under the original Allotment Act, that was supposed to be under a federal trust for 25 years. And then there was... If land was not allotted, then it was declared to be surplus land, and it was opened up for settlers. And anyway, what happened as a result of the General Allotment Act was between 1887 and 1934, two-thirds of land inside of reservation boundaries went under the jurisdiction, went out of the ownership of tribes and went into the two-thirds of the land became owned by non-Indians inside the reservation boundaries, which, you know, gets very confusing as to and so the law with regard to, you know, what applies to Indians inside the boundaries, what applies to non-Indians inside the boundaries, gets very, very complex. So you know, a case came down from the Supreme Court called Atkinson that says that tribes can't tax non-Indian businesses inside the reservation boundaries. Another case called Brendale essentially said that, you know, tribes can't zone non-Indian towns inside reservations. And so, but there's the land inside the reservation, which has its own confusing status. And as a result of the General Allotment Act, a lot of reservations in Minnesota and Wisconsin became these patchwork quilts of land ownership. And after 1934, tribes, the Indian Reorganization Act, tribes were allowed to, you know, try to acquire lands that they had lost. So the tribe had to purchase land and then get the United States to put it into federal trust status. So it's essentially taken off the tax rolls. And so... So there's, you know, there's all kinds of land inside reservation boundaries. And then ceded territories were, you know, that probably the most famous one in your region is the 1837 treaty, where tribes actually secured their hunting, fishing, gathering rights inside the ceded territory of the 1837 treaty, which cuts a big swath through Wisconsin and part of Minnesota. And so that got litigated in the Seventh Circuit and the Eighth Circuit as to the hunting, fishing, gathering rights of the Chippewa tribe. So, explaining to folks, they have to really understand the history. And so we actually have a guy from the Minnesota Department of Transportation who explains a lot of that. And he's an Indian guy, and he used to work for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And so he's able to, in Minnesota, we've got a couple of different disputes going on with regard to, you know, the size of some of the reservations. And so there's a state map of Minnesota and there's a federal map of Minnesota, and they're different. And he shows the difference. You know, he's been with the federal BIA and the federal EPA. And so from that job, he looked at the reservations from the federal perspective, and now he looks at it from the state perspective and kind of does a computerized program of the overlay of the federal map over the state map. And the federal map is much more generous with regard to the size of some of the reservations. And so, I mean, usually it's the federal government and the Department of Interior that make and the Department of Justice that determine where the reservation boundaries are, and sometimes the states will make some decisions on their own. So for a department like the Minnesota Department of Transportation, that gets really confusing because they have federal flow-through dollars. And so they've got federal money, and sometimes they're working with the federal transportation people who will say, no, this reservation starts right here. And MnDOT will go, well, you know, and then sometimes what they'll have to do is an agreement to disagree with the tribe on where the reservation is. So anyway, the land thing gets very complex. And it's important for them to understand. That's why we go through the history. It's kind of like, here's why this happened. Here's you know, we have people from the Department of Human Services, the Department of Health, the Department, and we explain how Indian Health Service works, and then we explain how the Indian Child Welfare Act came about and why it came about, and so it's important for them to understand the history. And most of them walk away saying, geez, I never heard this before. This is the first time I ever heard this stuff. And that's why we think, okay, we're doing a public service here by telling them, you know, they're spending a good deal of time very frustrated dealing with Indian tribes because they don't really understand a lot of the concepts and where they came from. And so it's a lot of thinking has to be done the first day, and a lot of focusing on whether it's Supreme Court precedents and their like. So, I mean, we get fairly high marks from people who take the course, and then occasionally we'll get the remarks about, you know, 90% of them are positive, I'm told, but I only pay attention to the 10% that are negative. And there were too many dates, too many statutes, too many law cases, et cetera. But from our perspective, we have to at least go through those to explain, and then we kind of try to underline the rules a couple of times. You know, the laws of states do not apply on reservations, and this is why you have to work with the tribes.
You've been listening to an interview with Tad Johnson, who heads the Masters of Tribal Administration and Governance program at the University of Minnesota in Duluth, and we're talking about tribal consultation. And we're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll talk about how far the process of tribal consultation has to go and how far it's come. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. In this hour, we've been talking with Tad Johnson, who is a member of the Boyce Fort Band of Chippewa in northern Minnesota, and he heads the Masters of Tribal Administration and Governance program at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. And we've been talking about tribal consultation. Johnson conducts trainings with Minnesota State employees about the process of consultation. And up next, he talks about how far the process has come and what could be improved.
They've come leaps and bounds from where they were. The great thing about the training is kind of people's eyes open up. And we have this display called Why Treaties Matter. And it was put together by the National Museum of the American Indian and the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, which is an entity comprised of all 11 tribes in Minnesota. And that kind of sits in the back of the room, and we tell them, please go look at that on your breaks. And it's quotes from tribal leaders from the past and then some current, you know. But you know, unless they understand that tribes are sovereign, the tribes are self-governing entities, and unless they understand that they are going to have to go out and talk and work something out with the tribes in order to do certain things on reservations, you know, but in order to get them there, we have to walk them through a great deal of history, and then explaining to them why, which is really the key question. They don't understand why this exists. You know, why is this still in place after, you know, we didn't, you know, we know you guys supposedly live on Indian reservations, and we know you call yourself sovereign, and we're like, well, we are sovereign. We do have self-governing rights. We do have authorities, and you know, and there's this whole string of Supreme Court cases from the early part of the history that kind of indicates what the rules are. And so that's why we go through that, and then followed by statutes. And so what's interesting is that there are a lot of folks in Congress that are, you know, one phenomenon that's occurred is that some tribes with money now have lobbyists out in Washington. When I started in Washington in 1990, there were probably 15 lobbyists doing the bread and butter issues out there, and now there's hundreds of lobbyists. I don't know most of them anymore. They're large law firms, and they're representing. You know, that was the advent of Indian gaming, allowed tribes to become economic and political players nationally. Most tribes are not. I mean, but the tribes that can afford to hire lobbyists will go out and lobby for still the bread and butter issues that are needed on the Great Plains, and tribes in northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin that don't have the resources to send a lobbyist out to Washington. So whether it's a vote on the House side or the Senate side, they've got the National Congress of American Indians and a number of individual lobbyists representing tribes out in Washington. So they're there to make sure that Washington hears from Indian tribes. Now, that's happening a little more at state legislatures as well. So state legislators are becoming a little more hip to, we should probably check with the Indian tribes, and even sometimes passing legislation where, I know you've got, I think it's Title 31 over in Wisconsin that was put in place during the treaty rights matter, where more educational programs would be put into place in Wisconsin public schools to teach about Indian tribes. But for the most part, these folks coming to this training have never had this information before. And so that's kind of keeps us going, because it's kind of like, just as we have to brief new congressmen, new senators, new state legislators, new mayors, new governors, new you name it, public non-Indian public officials on what we do. It's those folks that are out there, whether they're plowing snow or spraying pesticides or digging holes. They need to understand why when you get to an Indian reservation boundary or a site where Indians were, or you're in ceded territories, you may be in a fairly complicated legal situation and you need to go talk to somebody.
Well, is there anything else that I'm missing that you want to add about the history of tribal consultation or the process moving forward?
Just that, you know, throughout most of American history, tribes were not consulted on most of the policies that were made. It was really the advent of the 1970s and probably late 60s when tribes started getting more active and actually testifying in Congress, and then and now doing that with state legislatures. But it's really a matter of there's always been, you know, somebody from the state chatting with someone from the tribe. But I think it's what's happening in Minnesota is formalizing that consultation policy. And we see that happening in other states, and it's something that's probably got to happen because it's probably the best way to preempt any conflicts and avoid lawsuits, which, you know, we're hoping that's what we're doing in the long run.
You've been listening to an interview with Tad Johnson. He's a member of the Boy Sport Band of Chippewa in northern Minnesota, and he heads the Masters of Tribal Administration and Governance program at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.